Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by VPN.com. So I want to ask you a question. Do you use the internet? Well, of course you do. So did you know that every time you go online, your information is actually unprotected? Probably not. And it's true. Your passwords, emails, credit cards, and bank accounts are all exposed. You need a virtual private network or VPN to protect yourself. A VPN creates a private and secure internet connection for your device. But how do you find the right one when there are hundreds of VPNs out there? Luckily for you, VPN.com has spent thousands of hours visiting over 900 VPN websites to make your search quick and simple. They've collected everything from pricing and features to device compatibility, making it easy to find that VPN that best fits your needs and budget. Plus, it's totally free. So visit VPN.com to find your VPN and start protecting yourself today.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Tim Bergen. Did I say your name right? I always forget.
Yes, you did.
Bergen. I always forget. Yeah, Bergen or Bergen. So Tim Bergen on. He is the founder of the newsletter On Beyond Investing, which is awesome, by the way. And you can go to onbeyondinvesting.com for that. He's also a personal investor and manages his own money. Really smart guy. We had him on the show, it was about a year ago. And I love him so much, decided to bring him back. So welcome back on, Tim.
Well, thanks, Eric, and I appreciate the kind words.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to use this episode today to revisit macro enterprises. This was something you had brought up a little over a year ago when you were first on the show, and essentially it was a pipeline company trading below liquidation value. So can you give us a little update on what's happened? What are your views now? Does the thesis apply? Were you wrong? Were you right? You know, fill us in.
Yeah, sure. And it's always interesting to take a look back, I think, because there's always, you can reevaluate exactly like you said, were you correct or was there some spots you missed?
And especially when you do it on a podcast where it's on the record, you can't justify it to yourself in your head that you thought something differently.
Absolutely. So I didn't go back and listen to the old podcast, so I'll just assume what I said was pretty good. So the story actually has evolved in an interesting way, because the thesis before was, this was a company trading well below liquidation. I think at the time I thought liquidation was like $2.80 a share. It was trading around $2. And it was interesting because there were some big infrastructure projects on the horizon in Canada, specifically near where Macro is positioned. And they have, a founder, CEO that owns 33%. They weathered through the downturn because they had very little debt. They had a ton of cash and they had a very large revolver. So the market cap of the company at $2 a share is like 60 million. They have, I believe, $100 or $120 million line of credit, undrawn line of credit. Mm-hmm. So the thesis was, well, if they can't find new projects, then you're covered by liquidation. But there's a couple huge projects, and if they land any of them, then you could have some big upside. So what's interesting is over the past year, earnings grew fairly substantially from the previous year, which was obviously quite low. And they did get awarded a big contract. So they got awarded a contract by Kinder Morgan to make their to help construct a portion of their Trans Mountain pipeline. And year over year, revenues grew 100%. It was $104 million in 2017. Earnings just came out yesterday. And in 2016, it was $54 million. And some of that was just a pickup of service work. In the downturn, when oil crashed, pipeline companies probably stopped all non-essential maintenance. So there was some catch-up work for them to do. So what's just interesting now is their earnings came out, and I think the market was a bit nervous that overall margins dipped. But this is, roughly $60 million market cap. Cash from operations was a little over four, and there was some development costs for getting ready for this Trans Mountain project, which in years past, I haven't had a chance to talk to the CFO, but in years past, that had been somewhere around $1 million, $1.5 million. It wouldn't shock me if it was double now. So you're looking at a company, $60 million market cap, arguably earned somewhere between $4 and $7 million in free cash flow, because the free cash flow is higher than earnings because they tend to aggressively depreciate their assets. Mm-hmm. So book value's $260 a share, and arguably the equipment is worth a good deal more than is on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is I project that if this Trans Mountain gets built, you could see $1.20 in earnings per share. So I don't really think, in some ways the story's gotten better. I think it's still probably worth $2.80 in liquidation, and probably still, it could earn this $1.20 from Kinder Morgan over a 2-year period. So you're looking at, I think the share price somewhere in the $3.80 to $4 range is probably fair. Obviously,
$2 stock today.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think people were a little concerned that margins were lower, and they did say that, the early part of 2018 activity was really low.
Yep.
And obviously, there's a construction company, so it's kind of like discrete projects. And I assume they had already allocated a lot of people towards Trans Mountain. So you could see why it would be low absent that construction work, which I assume they expected was going to occur.
So do you see any ways where you could lose money on this?
Well, you could always lose money if it just bleeds away over time.
Right.
But the CEO, he owns 33%, and he managed the last downturn pretty well. There's very little debt. It's like $43 million in, net current assets. Could you bleed away over time? Sure. But, even if you put aside the Kinder Morgan project, and maybe we should get into some of the politics behind there. Maybe we'll do that real quick as a background. So what's going on is the new government came into the province of BC. Mm-hmm. And it was a coalition between the NDP and the Green Party. And one of their, mandates or promises or whatever you want to call it, was that they were going to block this Trans Mountain project. And this Trans Mountain project brings oil from Alberta to the shore to be exported to external markets. Currently now, almost all the oil in Canada just gets sold to the United States. So this gives us an extra market to sell into. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, the production in Alberta has exceeded the pipeline capacity to take it anywhere. And there's a couple different pipelines proposed, like obviously Keystone, that most people have heard about, but Kinder Morgan has been the only one that actually got official approval by the government. And it's interesting because it's an expansion project, so it's actually running almost parallel to a pipeline that already exists and has existed for, a couple decades now. And what's interesting, so there's more there's more oil being produced than there's pipelines to take it away. And so the differential between the price that the Canadian oil gets and the price of, a regular U.S. Barrel of oil produced is $20 a barrel. which is pretty significant. And at the widest, it was as wide as 32 just a couple of months ago. So this project will add another, I think it's 500,000 barrels. So you're looking at savings to the Canadian oil producers of somewhere between 3.5 and 4 billion per year. And like I said, the federal government, you know, passed all the environmental, and they give it the blessing. And so what's interesting is this government has come in and said they're just going to block it any way they can. But constitutionally, they don't actually have the right to do so. Mm-hmm. So they can try and obstruct, you know, through different lawsuits, but they don't actually have the legal authority. You know, I don't really think the Canadian government wants to take this as a seat, like make this a constitutional issue, but it's very clear, and I'm mm-hmm. not a legal expert, but it's very clear to almost everybody that this is just in the authority of the federal government. So Kinder Morgan gave an ultimatum, basically saying that we can't, you know, the delaying of the project just impedes our ability to, like, it's just too much risk. Like, we can't build half a pipeline and then the whole project gets shut down. So they said, unless the government can step in, we'll shut down the project May 31st. And what's somewhat ironic is the last time we were speaking about macro enterprises, it was known that they could get work through this Trans Mountain, but the other one that seemed more probable is they could get a big LNG project uh-huh. in BC. And so what's somewhat ironic is the same BC party that's blocking the Trans Mountain is trying to push ahead with LNG investment in the province. Which I don't really understand. You know, and I'm somebody that's, you know, concerned about the climate and so on and so forth, but in the respect of this Trans Mountain, the Canadian government linked it to a carbon tax. So they said, you know, well, we're going to have a carbon tax in Canada, it's going to go up, but in conjunction with that, we are approving this project. So I thought it was a fair balance between environmental concerns and business and huge savings as an elected government, and it's under their constitutional authority. So the government's come out pretty forcefully in statement, like the prime minister is saying, you know, don't get me wrong, like this will get built. And the leaders of the of Alberta are saying, you know, we'll even invest in the project to make it happen. You know, so I would think the odds are greater than 50-50. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who knows? Like I said, I'm far from a legal expert on these matters. But if you're given the legal backing and the economic backing, you think something like this probably gets done. And if it does, then that's $1.20, I believe, in earnings to macro. I think where the market maybe is a little hesitant today is that they're operating or gross margins were much lower than they had been historically. But I think there's some, you know, construction, there's some expenses that come up front, which yeah. hopefully doesn't. I think people are implying that maybe that means lower margins, and maybe it does. You know, I haven't had a chance to speak to the CFO, who I've spoken to numerous times. He's very sharp. But I don't believe that to be the case. So, but even still, like, you know, $2 a share, even if they make 70 cents a share, you know, almost half of what I expected, that's still pretty significant earnings for such a small company.
Yeah. What percent allocation of this is your portfolio in this?
Oh, in this, I think it's 5-ish%.
Okay. Do you typically stay pretty concentrated, or like would that be a small or a big position for you, something like that?
That would be, so it's 6-ish% now that I look at it. Mm-hmm. I tend to be fairly concentrated, so like if I look at like my biggest five positions are 75% of my portfolio.
Okay.
But then you know, I do have a bunch of smaller ones, and then I have a bunch of shorts.
Got it.
But in shorts, like, I'll be like, maybe I'll be long in total 12 different names, and I'll be short in total maybe 15 to 20 different names, something mm-hmm. like that.
Okay.
But I tend to be, yeah, on the long side, I tend to be a bit more concentrated, and actually probably on the short more concentrated than most. And actually probably sometimes I think more concentrated than a reasonable person would do. But, when you're managing your own money, you can do that.
Yeah. Interesting. Anything else about Macro Enterprises?
Well, I think the other thing that's interesting is, there's other projects. Mm-hmm. So there's a similar glut of natural gas in Alberta that doesn't have a market to go to. So there could be more LNG projects going forward. There's a bunch of maintenance work to continue to get done. And these guys, you know, have proven to be able to win big contracts. And they've been proven to survive through the downturn. So it feels like asymmetric, which is my favorite type of position.
Oh, yeah. Have you read any of the Seeking Alpha articles that are negative on the company? Or like there's one like why I sold Macro Enterprises at the recent pop?
Oh, yeah. I think that's just people... just like it's taking a long time to play out.
Let's see. So I want to hear your thoughts on this. I'm going to give you a summary of the article and you tell me.
Yeah, I recall reading that a couple of months back.
Yeah, so here's an article. It's by, I have no idea how to pronounce this guy's name. It's Ruerd, so Ruerd Heeg. It sounds like some Scandinavian guy or something. And he describes himself as a quantitative deep value and he's a book author. So, summary. So it's four points. Tell me what you think. Point one, in 2016, I bought Macro Enterprises because it was cheap relative to liquidation value and had a low enterprise to EBIT multiple. Sounds reasonable
to you? Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Point two, the stock now, this is from September 2017, so it's a few months dated. The stock now has a negative EBIT. And because the stock has risen so much, the discount to liquidation value is gone.
I think that was somewhat true, but it's kind of ignoring the fact that the stock was up because they were awarded this massive contract.
And back then, it was trading around $250 a share back then.
Right.
All right, then the third thing is the company is less shareholder-friendly than I originally thought. The recent pop provided me a good opportunity to get out. I don't know where he gets that sense from.
Yeah, so they issued options to themselves, which the optics didn't look great. If you spoke to them, they were just trying to incentivize guys to stay.
Okay.
Like activity was starting to pick up. He's like, you know, if you're issuing equity to the guys that stuck with you when times were tough and everybody made sacrifices, then it's he's like, we thought it'd be a good way to incentivize those guys to stick around and motivate them to continue as we think activity progresses. So, you know, Did I love the way it was done? No. The strike on the shares they picked was pretty low. So I could see why some people have qualms with it, but
sure.
But after speaking to him, I wasn't as concerned as I was when I originally, you know, read it in the press release or in the earnings report or wherever I saw it.
Yeah. And there was only three bullet points, by the way, not four.
Yeah. Think on an EBIT basis, I think these guys are, be on an EBITDA basis, but I think people, like if you didn't take into account the value of this contract, which could be substantial,
mm-hmm.
then sure, yeah. Like if you're a pure net guy, then you bought it at 2, and then it went up to close to what you thought book value was, and you sold it, you know, I guess I can't really fault that. But I think the interesting net-nets are like when you buy it a lot below liquidation and you have some big upside because the business actually can have very strong performance. And
yeah, you know, it's interesting about that. Are you know Jeff Gannon? He's been on the show before.
Yep.
So he did a post, I think it was fairly recent, and he talked about net-nets. And he was saying that, you know, he did a, you know, there's been a lot of Japanese net nets, and he was saying, you know, he invested in a bunch of them, and people were like, oh, you must have been where some of them were home runs, and some of them went to zero, and a few of them just did nothing. And he's like, no, that really isn't true. Most of them worked out. And people are always shocked. And he basically said that the reason most of his net investments have worked out is that he uses like common sense. So he's like, you know, when you do a screen and, you know, you have relatively good performance, you have some of these companies that have just been bleeding cash forever and have just been like net nets forever and have like, you know, not fraudulent management, but they're clearly doing unethical things that are still technically illegal. So he said when you just like weed out a bunch of that stuff and I'm paraphrasing, but when you weed out a bunch of that stuff and you just kind of look for things like what you said, right? It's like very cheap. Clearly there's like real businesses there and there's some kind of future. There's nothing wrong with them. You tend to limit your downside a lot more.
Yeah. And that's, I think other people have mentioned it, like maybe even Nate at Oddball Stocks, like it's a kind of like a two pillar stock, you know, like it's cheap on a liquidation basis, but it also has some earning potential upside.
Yeah. Then there is the argument to be made too. There's Tobias Carlyle, who also actually has been on the show, the guy who started the Acquirers Multiple, and he was saying, if you read his book, he talks about how if you had a basket, but again, he's doing it purely quantitative, right? So if you had a basket of net nets that like pay dividends and stuff, so it's like dividend net nets actually perform worse than non-dividend paying net nets. And net nets that are losing money as a whole did better than net nets that were making money.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Like it, I guess because they're just so hated,
right? Yeah, and again, his what he was saying to me was like, in general, you know, if a company continues losing money, like they're going to start cutting costs. Like they're not going to just like hang out there and do nothing forever. So, you know, all it takes is a few of those companies to not be bleeding cash anymore, and you know, you'll have a triple digit returns for those.
Yeah, he's big on the reversion to mean of just the operating of the business. He's a smart guy.
Very, very smart guy.
He's a smart guy. I think I listened to that podcast. It was a good one. So, I agree with that. I agree with that. And what's interesting in this case is, like you have a company that has the ability to start making money going forward, then you also allow yourself the ability of the market to start pricing this off earnings.
Right.
Right. That's how you really make a home run, is like when you buy something cheap on assets and then it starts producing earnings and then people start giving it a 10 multiple on earnings. And that's where really large returns can come from.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not sure if 100% right in this, but I believe at one point, like, Apple was a net.
I think years ago it was, like, in the early 2000s.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, almost no net investor, I'm sure, held it for the whole time. And I certainly probably wouldn't have myself. But, you know, I think it is interesting. Like, if something is showing encouraging signs, you know, they're landing big contracts that may or may not happen due to political reasons, but at least they landed them. Mm-hmm. There's other huge projects potentially in the pipeline. You know, it's an owner operator. He owns 33%. You know, I tend to think you give that one a bit more runway. Whereas there's other ones where, like some financials, I don't like owning banks much more above 1x book.
Yeah.
And maybe except for an exceptional one, it may be like 1.2. And maybe I'm wrong, but that just how I am. So when I was buying community banks back in the day, you know, they did quite well over the last couple of years. I always sold them too early because I would, you know, sell at roughly book or, you know, if I didn't think it was actually a great bank, maybe I'd sell it a bit below book or a bit above if I thought it was a bit better. But, you know, so the guy who wrote the article, I would agree with him in some net cases or below book value cases. But I think if the company has is showing the ability to actually produce pretty great returns, then maybe be a bit more patient.
Yeah, you know what are two interesting? I think they were both net-nets. They certainly traded below book value. Do you remember? They're still around. They're still publicly traded. One was called E-Plus, and the other one was called Gravity Co. You ever hear of either of those?
No, actually, I haven't. Can't say I have.
Yeah, so Gravity was it still is. It's a South Korean company, and they do like software development, like video games and stuff. Has gone from, like, literally from when I first heard about it was, I think, 2008 or something, 2009. It was trading at, like, it would hover between, like, $5 and $8 a share, and then really didn't do anything. And then in 2015, it's trading at, like, $3.01 in February 2016. And then from February 2016 to now, it's gone from $3.01 to $80.19.
Yeah, that's amazing. Right?
And then there's E-Plus. I don't remember what they do. Let's see. They're an American IT asset selling and financing company headquartered in Virginia. Yeah, a lot of these companies, I didn't care what they did, right? And they've gone from 2001, they were trading at 453, and then in 2008, they're trading at almost the same price. And then starting in 2009, they go from $5 and change to peaking at $95 a share. In 2017, they're around $80 now.
Yeah,
another one of those.
Yeah. And actually, to go back to the other thing, the other reason why the guy might say they're not shareholder friendly is the company has always had a lot of cash, and so, you know, the obvious thing, and it's trading below liquidation. So the obvious thing from an investor point of view is like, well, they should be buying back shares. And I think investors can miss the point. And the point in this case is that, according to the CFO, per $100 million in revenue, they require something like $30 million-ish in working capital.
Yeah.
So they always like to have that working capital on hand so they can self-fund themselves. But if you kind of do, like, you kind of reverse engineer it. So if they have $100 million in revolver just sitting there, plus I think they have 45 in cash, that implies like these guys think they have enough capital and assets in place to do up to $400 million in revenues.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, who knows if they ever get there, but I mean, like, they seem to think there's some type of probability, and so some people might say, well, yeah, they should have bought back shares. And then I think if you take a long-term view, you're like, no, you know, these guys have been good with capital, and if they think they can, you know, self-fund until they hit some big contracts, and I think that's probably a better use of capital than buying back shares.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but if they took their earnings from this year and bought back shares, obviously I'd be fine with that. But like on the margin, if they did, sure. And they did some last year, but not a lot. It was pretty small. But yeah, that's one of those topics where I think investors miss the point that, if you speak to management or if you speak to somebody in business, they would have a very different view.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Anything else, or you think that that's it for this company?
I think that about covers it.
Cool. Well, hey, Tim, it was great to have you back on briefly and giving us an update with Macro Enterprises. And maybe in a year from now, we can revisit if that works for you.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, Tim, have a great day, and I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.